This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Not many people have ever won an election by saying that Medicare is bad. In fact, people who say that tend to lose elections by large numbers. So it's no surprise that in a recent survey, 98% of adults 18 or older said that Medicare is important to Americans' health and retirement. But what about the health of Medicare itself?
Most people pay 25%. As taxpayers, the rest of us pay the other 75%.
On today's Health Show, we're going to be joined by two representatives of the American Association of Retired People, AARP. And we'll talk about the future of Medicare and Social Security and what AARP is doing to support their members. Dr. Nina Sachs is away this week. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Just about everybody has heard of AARP. Some of us have reached the age where they're sending us mailers every month or so asking us to join. Those mailers must work. AARP has over 37 million members aged 50 and older. Whether you agree or disagree with their positions, they are recognized as a powerful lobbying force working for older Americans. And one of the biggest concerns of older Americans these days is the future of Medicare and Social Security. We've invited a couple of representatives from AARP to the program today to talk about that future. Cheryl Mathias is a senior vice president for policy who has been with AARP for over 25 years. And Neil Lane is the former director of the New York State Office for the Aging and is now a volunteer member of the AARP National Policy Council. He's also a member of the Executive Council of AARP New York. Cheryl, let's talk about Medicare and Social Security. They're almost always mentioned together like they're joined at the hip, but they're really two different programs funded in two different ways, right?
Okay, well, Social Security was started in 1935, and it is funded by payroll taxes. You know, everybody who gets it from the time they get their first paycheck, they see that 6.2% that's taken out of it. And what they don't know maybe is that their employer is paying another 6.2%, and that goes into the Social Security Trust Fund, which is the money that is used to pay current Social Security beneficiaries. So Social Security, that is the only way it's funded. Up till now, and actually until 2033, there is enough money to pay full Social Security benefits.
Yeah, that program is not really in trouble. I mean, maybe down the road, but right now it's not in trouble.
It has a financial challenge for the future generations, mm-hmm. but it is fine for the immediate term.
Then there's Medicare.
Medicare. Now, Medicare has a bigger challenge, but Medicare is funded differently. Remember, Medicare started in 1965, not 1935. And Medicare, which is the health insurance program for people who are generally 65 and older, is funded in two different ways. One way is that there is another amount taken out of your paycheck. It's 1.45% of your pay and a matching for the employer. And that goes into what's known as the Part A, which is Hospital Trust Fund. And so everybody who works pays into the Hospital Trust Fund. Everybody who turns 65 is automatically eligible for Part A. Part B, which is doctor's services, is paid differently, and you actually have to sign up for Part B. Part B you pay a premium for, just like you would for any insurance policy. And when they sign up for it, they pay a monthly premium. Generally, because people are retired and are getting Social Security at that point, the premium is a deduction from their Social Security check each month, so they don't really write a check out. But that premium pays for the doctor services. And then, to make it more complicated, we have a Part D, which is the prescription drug benefit that was enacted in 2003. The prescription drug benefit you have to choose to get, and you have to pay a premium for that too. And that's a premium that you actually write a check for mm-hmm. to a private insurance company that you choose to give you that benefit. You know, Medicare, when it was enacted in 1965, prescription drugs were not a big part of medicine at the time. And since then, you know, the developments in medications have exploded to the point where now an average 50-year-old takes 4 prescriptions a day. So people rely on these to keep themselves healthy. And so everybody needs these medications. So we've, you know, discussed it for years and years. Our AARP's members told us they wanted us to get a prescription drug benefit at Medicare. And finally, in 2003, Congress agreed to put it in. But part of the deal, the sausage making that is legislation, mm-hmm. is that in order to get it in and to get everybody to vote for it, it was under President George W. Bush, it had to be offered by a private insurance company. The desire was, we'll let you do it if you let private insurance companies compete for the business. And so that's why it's administered by the government, but private insurance companies are the ones you buy the program from. The rules are government rules. Everybody has to play by the same rules. But the private insurance companies decide on what they call the formulary, because sometimes there's different drugs for the same condition. So they decide which drugs are covered, as long as the full range of conditions are covered, and they decide the premium.
And if the government was not involved, would the premium be higher?
That's a matter of opinion.
Okay. And then there's...
I would say that where you would really expect a great difference if the government was not involved would be in what drugs were offered at what amounts.
And this is not a mandatory thing. Nobody comes up to your door and says, why haven't you signed up?
That's correct.
No, it's not mandatory, but as with Part B, Part B and D are voluntary, but people need to understand that if they do not sign up when they are first eligible, while they can sign up later, it will cost them more.
Right.
Just an aside, what happened to Part C?
Part C still exists. Part C is what we call the Medicare Advantage program, and that is a program which combines everything into one fell swoop. It combines it into what some people call a managed care or a health maintenance organization, and those are private organizations that contract with the government to offer both hospital, physician, prescription drug, the whole shebang. And if you sign up for Part C for Medicare Advantage, you pay your Medicare Advantage premium, which takes the place of your Part B. You still have to pay your Part B premium, but you don't pay your Part D premium separately. You pay a Medicare Advantage premium, but you also then don't buy a supplemental policy. A lot of people who have Medicare buy another private insurance policy because even though people love Medicare and they think it's wonderful, which it is not nearly as comprehensive as your average employer-provided health insurance. And a lot of people I know who, when they turn 65 and they get into Medicare, they say, oh, wow, I didn't know this. But the fact is that most people decide that they need to buy supplemental coverage to cover their medical expenses once they're on Medicare. But if you go with the Part C, you don't buy the supplemental coverage.
Okay. We're hearing about the financial problems with the system. What is, in 25 words or less, which is impossible, what are the financial problems going in?
The biggest problem that we have, there are really two. The biggest one of the two is the ever-increasing cost to the general health care system. We spend an inordinate amount of money for our health care in this country, twice what most other countries do, and don't get the outcomes that many of those other countries do. So the cost is big. We also have the phenomenon of the baby boomers now aging into the Medicare system, and that is a big number. And as a result of their aging, the low birth rates after their boom, we will have fewer workers. So we have fewer people paying into the system while they're working and greater numbers drawing on the system after they've retired.
Are the premiums enough to fund the Parts B and D?
No, they are not. They were designed to cover part of the cost. For Part B, the doctor services, most people pay 25%. And actually, as taxpayers, they and the rest of us pay the other 75%. Although people of higher incomes, as of several years ago, are now paying more. And people of the highest income are actually paying up to 85% of the cost of the insurance.
Mm-hmm. And therein lies the problem, though, is that if it's just a fraction, then everybody else has to make up and the pot's just getting smaller.
And as Neil said, you know, one of the things we have to do is bring down the overall cost of health care. And another thing we need to do in Medicare is do some sort of financial changes to make it sustainable because of the baby boom. But that's a separate issue.
Hmm. Right.
We talk about the American healthcare system a lot as if it was just this one big system that all operated under one set of rules. But it's really, it's private enterprise.
First off, AARP to some concern from a portion of its membership was a strong supporter of the Affordable Care Act. And the Affordable Care Act does do a number of things to try to squeeze down the increasing costs and improve care at the same time. A good example of that is what's called ACOs, or Accountable Care Organizations. And that's a new concept in the ACA that brings together multiple providers, hospitals, physicians, home care, into one organization that integrates the care for the individual. Now, that's very different than it is today, because today you would go to the hospital that isn't affiliated with anybody but the hospital. You'd go to a physician who may or may not be affiliated with the hospital, and you'd get your home care and therapies from some other organization, and none of that is integrated. Now, the concept here is that ACOs, Accountable Care Organizations, will be accountable for the outcomes, so that they will make their money based on the outcomes. Good outcomes will result in greater funding for the organization. Poor outcomes, they'll be penalized.
And the other thing about that is that, you know, if you think about it, and probably most of your listeners will have this experience, I know I certainly have, you know, if you get sick and you go to the doctor and the doctor says, you know, I have to do a CAT scan. And you get the CAT scan from the place downstairs from the doctor's office, and they say, oh, you better go to the hospital. Then you go to the hospital, and the hospital says, oh, no, we have to do our own CAT scan. So you have a lot of duplication of services, which just runs up costs. So things that will help are electronic medical record systems, where the systems will talk to each other, so the hospital will know and trust what the doctor's office has done, and have a stake in not just running up costs. You know, if you have your bathroom floor tiled and the tile guy makes a mistake, you don't pay him to do it over. But if you go to the hospital and the hospital makes a mistake, oftentimes you pay him to do it over. Now, Medicare actually has recently instituted some rules where they said, under certain circumstances, we're not paying for do-overs. And that makes the hospital a lot more careful about whether they do it right, and it does cut down on costs for the system. So there are ways in which we can work to produce a lower cost and actually a better quality of care for the patient.
Still to come, we'll continue our conversation with representatives from AARP with a look at how they reach out to their members. That's next on The Health Show. You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. You can start your own Health Show archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1292. This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guests today are Cheryl Mathias, a senior vice president for policy who's been with AARP for over 25 years, and Neil Lane, former director of the New York State Office for the Aging and now a volunteer member of the AARP National Policy Council. We mentioned that AARP has over 37 million members, so let's talk about them. What are the issues you hear about most often from your members?
Oh, gosh. You know, the main thing I would say that concerns our members, I would put under the whole rubric of retirement security. People are really afraid that their money is going to run out.
Yeah.
And that has to do with their health care as well as their pension or financial resources. Financial people tell you, you know, when you retire, you need to have at least $250,000 put aside for your health care for the rest of your life. Ask how many people how much money they have put aside for their health care. You know, I saw recently a number that said the average person who retires has like $50,000 as their total assets. Well, that's one-fifth of what they're supposed to put aside for their health care. That doesn't include their living expenses. How many people in New York State live only on Social Security?
Somewhere around 25-26%.
And we're a fairly affluent state, so when you go down to some of the poorer states, that's...
Oh, it's got to be much higher.
Yeah.
When you have an average benefit...
$14,000.
And that's the average. Think about a lot of people who are actually pulling in less than that. And we meet these people all the time. When we go out and talk and somebody says, you know, I'll say 14,000 is the average. And they'll say, oh, my mom lived on a lot less than that.
Right. And going back to Medicare, now we're seeing a lot of proposals, a lot of ideas, a lot of talk about tinkering, about we've heard during the election season that just passed that this many billion is being cut and that many billion is being cut. Is anything being cut?
Well, you know, I think everyone understands, you know, the numbers that were thrown out was $716 billion. And frankly, they were supported by both parties until the ads for the election came out. But the $716 billion that was included, these were considered to be provider cuts, that which means they were not beneficiary cuts. They were included in the Affordable Care Act. They were mostly reductions in future payments to hospitals, which hospitals agreed they could absorb because they were going to get more business from more patients with insurance, and reductions in future payments to those Medicare Advantage plans who, when they were first brought into being, were actually paid more than Medicare fee-for-service was paid. So that because of the formula and because there was a desire at the time to make them very enticing for people to go into these private plans, they were given a higher rate of reimbursement, even though initially, as health maintenance organizations, they said, hey, we can coordinate care and do it for less. They were actually doing it for more. And so the taxpayer was paying more money. So what the law does is gradually phase that back down so that it's even with Medicare fee-for-service. And that's really where those savings or cuts are coming from. So they are actually reductions in increases in future payment, and they're ones that everyone at the time agreed were reasonable reductions that would not hurt beneficiaries and would not hurt quality of care.
We hear anecdotally, though, that some doctors say that, well, they keep reducing how much they pay me. I'm just not going to take Medicare patients anymore. Is that a fear?
Well, I think it is a fear. Currently, we're looking at a 30% reduction in what the federal government reimburses physicians for office visits. And that is a serious problem, and we have to get past. It's known in Washington as the doc fix, and we have to be realistic in terms of what we pay physicians. Now, clearly, the big problem is that we don't have enough primary care physicians, and there's some suggestion that we overutilize and perhaps overpay for our specialty services. So there has to be some realignment there so that we have sufficient primary care physicians to coordinate our care and do have the specialists when we need them, but only when we need them.
It may seem odd that we're saying on the one hand we did reductions in what the hospitals and what the managed care organizations got, and that was a good thing. And we're worried about reductions in what the physicians were getting. But the formula to reduce the physician pay, everyone agrees that it's not an accurate formula. And every year we have to do something to stop the reduction. But that means that the next year the reduction gets higher. So now it's almost 30%. And it's a meat axe. It's not a well-designed realignment of what we're paying. And so that we cannot allow to go forward because it really would interfere with people's ability to get care from physicians.
And that's something that just gets kicked down the road every few years.
Right. And as Cheryl noted, every year that it's kicked down the road, it gets more expensive to fix.
Well, we talked about how AARP has a lot of members. How are you hearing their voices? What type of a mechanism do you have that members can come up to you and say, I have this fear or I have this idea?
One of the things we actually decided this year that we wanted to use every channel AARP had to listen to our members. And that's why we started this initiative called You've Earned a Say. The idea being that you pay into Medicare and Social Security, and you have earned the opportunity to have your say in how they're made strong for the long term. So we set up a dedicated website called earnedasay.org. Put lots of really good information on it, including information that was not AARP's viewpoint, but pros and cons of how we could do things to make the program stronger from people who were known for either being a conservative or a liberal. So people could basically look at it. It respects the viewer and lets them make their own decision as to what they want. It also allows them to communicate directly with AARP and tell us what they think. And the whole idea was that we wanted to make it easy for our members to have their voices heard because we knew they were telling us that they didn't think anyone was listening. Now, in addition to this, that's a website. And, you know, I know some people do not use the internet. So we have other ways. You know, we have 800 numbers and people call us. And we keep track of the calls that come in and what they're about. And we have trained operators who try to answer people's questions when they're direct questions. We have a whole communications department that keeps track of letters and emails and responds to all of them. We do things called teletown halls, which is a way, you know, we have a lot of in-person meetings. I know folks out there who are our members probably maybe went to a community meeting that AARP had. And if you have a community meeting, you can get 60, 80, 100 people in a room and you can talk. And that's a great thing. But when you have 37 million members, you need to do more than that. So what we did is we came up with this idea of things called telephone town halls or teletown halls. And basically, within an area, like an area of a state, we call people whose numbers we have and tell them that we're going to have a discussion about Medicare and Social Security. And if they want to participate, they stay on the line. We get very high participation rates. I mean, the companies that do this for us say, you know, nobody else gets as many people staying on the line. These are usually an hour-long program. And people who stay on the line for 10, 15, 20 minutes or more of the hour, which is a really good chunk of time, they get to put their questions in. So their questions go in the queue. We answer as many questions as we can. The questions we can't answer, we try to find other ways to get back to them. And you can actually participate with like 5,000 to 7,000 people at a time on that kind of an event. So we try to come up with every kind of event we can. We have an office in every single state. And we have, over the past year, engaged with 5.5 million people in this matter, which is a pretty, I mean, it's not 37 million, but it's a pretty big number for an organization to be able to reach out to, ask their opinions, and listen to them.
How pliable is the policy of AARP? Can the management of AARP say, well, this is the way we want to go, but gee, all our members want that? Do you say, well, we don't think it's right, but the members want it?
Well, the policy committee is, I'll use the analogy, is put off in a clean room, for lack of a better way to put it. We are separated from any of the activities, other activities of AARP. And as Cheryl mentioned, we took the input from the 5.5 million members, and we, as of 25 volunteers, set the policy for the organization. Now, that policy has to be approved by the board, but in fact, it always is, because it's been well-reasoned and reflects the desires of the membership and what's good for older Americans and their families. No one from the leadership of the organization comes in and delivers any message other than, we need you to come up with the best policies that represents the members and their families. And it's a very separate process from anything else. And I attend, as many as my peers do, I try to attend the teletown halls, I try to attend the community forums, I try to be around the state to hear directly from our members about what they feel, and then take that to Washington.
Cheryl Mathias is a senior vice president for policy who's been with AARP for over 25 years. Neil Lane is the former director of the New York State Office for the Aging and is now a volunteer member of the AARP National Policy Council. He's also a member of the Executive Council of AARP New York. You can have your say in the conversation with AARP at that website, earnedasay.org. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org. Dr. Nina Sachs will be back with us next week. I'm Bob Barrett. Till then, stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer.
The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.